pues que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3, entra en grupobauan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Bauan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and this is the continuation of my last program. On my last program, I began to talk about the Merino sheep and how its wool, the lana, was improved and how it could get increasingly higher prices in the markets, in the clothing manufacturing areas. In Tuscany, right, remember that Florence was a great cloth manufacturer and clothing manufacturer. Florence, where modern banking began as a logical extension of cloth manufacture. The fact is that you could do you could write a very good history of the world in terms of textiles, right? The history of textiles has been the history of the world, the rise and fall. Certainly, the history of art. You had textile manufacture, you had banking, and you had the Renaissance there in Florence. The same thing. You had textile manufacture, you had clothing manufacture in Flanders, and lots of money, lots of financial innovation, and again, a Renaissance. Spain, Aragon, the logical place to send that wool was, as I say, Italy, Tuscany. In Castile, the logical place was Flanders. And so you had not tens of thousands, but millions of sheep constantly on the move in these cañadas reales. This transhumancia practically never stopped, with groups of sheep, flocks of sheep, numbering in the thousands, not just in the cañadas, but pretty much everywhere. And as I mentioned on my last program, this had a very, very damaging, very deleterious, very prejudicial effect on the development of agriculture in Castile, right? Today, of course, you look around and there are beautiful dehesas. There are wonderful things that are oriented toward, as I say, the breeding of animals rather than agriculture, precisely for this reason. People who devoted their time and energy to agriculture, they were not considered gentlemen, and a person who was considered a gentleman could not do it. So that, yes, for centuries, travelers and many of the let's call it progressively thinking Spanish intellectuals have just wondered why the country was filled with hidalgos who did not deign dignarse, no? Que no se dignaban, who did not deign to work. They would refuse to work. They would starve. Pasaron hambre, but at least they remained gentlemen, right? And this goes back to La Feria de Tormes, right? You know that one of his masters
were the one in Toledo, if I remember correctly. Yes, to all appearances, he was a gentleman and doing very well. But he, in fact, was hungry, poor, and not at all happy in the world. But would not think about changing his lifestyle. He wanted to be a gentleman. Now, this has an advantage in other places, you have the idea of cuanto tienes tanto vales, right? So that possessions, people judge you by your possessions. And that is not a Spanish tradition. But at the same time, it was an impediment to the development of agriculture and industry in Spain. As I mentioned before, the mesta was considered proper for gentlemen. And so you had members of the nobility and members of the clergy who were investors. And this became a powerful lobby, unstoppable. The crown probably couldn't cross the Mesta, right? Even if they wanted to, the Mesta was too powerful, first. Secondly, the whole economy was now dependent on this easy money from the export of raw material, materia prima, raw material, that no value added, right, except the esquiladores, the shearers. There would be no value added to this wool. It didn't occur to anyone to have the textiles made here. And these people had their own laws, their own privileges. So that if you went against the Mesta, for example, if you had a farm and you built a fence, or if you knew that the sheep were coming and tried to protect your crops, then you would be judged by the Mesta according to their own rules, from which there was no appeal. Right? They had their own jurisdiction. They had privileges. And yes, doing irreparable damage to the land. Fields that could have been productive were used for pasto, grazing. And, yes, as a result, many of the villages, the small villages, which are deserted today, right, La España Vacía, many of them were in these areas, right, controlled by the Mesta. Big names, several of the major owners could have, 20,000, 30,000 sheep. Owning those sheep and exporting that wool to the Low Countries, to Flanders, where it was taken advantage of, and that's where the money was. I also mentioned on the program earlier that before the end of the 18th, the beginning of the 19th century, exporting merinos from Spain was a crime. It was punishable by death. It was a capital crime. However, The king, of course, gave, you know, gave a few examples to his cousin. This was in 1723. Some were exported to Sweden. Some to the, well, it was the Elector of Saxony, right? Cousin to Carlos III, who got these sheep and began to take advantage of them. The monopoly was reduced at that point. But, yeah, some were sent to Saxony and from there to Hungary and to Prussia. Then Louis XVI of France received 400 sheep and set them up on the royal farm in Rambouillet. And the Rambouillet sheep in France, still, you know, this is the origin of France's most prestigious breed of sheep today. Now, all of this changed during the Napoleonic invasion. In the Napoleonic invasion, it was suddenly considered patriotic to export that sheep, right? Because the intention was to ruin the merino flocks and take away the possible rivalry, commercial rivalry, with France. Obviously, the English got these sheep from through Portugal, and so from there to England, from England to South Africa, from South Africa to Australia. In the year 1802, the ambassador to Spain, Colonel David Humphreys, the American ambassador to Spain, right, the newly formed United States, so grateful to Spain, because obviously without Spanish help, the United States would never have existed. And that gratitude was profoundly and deeply felt and expressed at the time. Later on, of course, probably eclipsed and forgotten, but at that time, in the United States, felt very, very strongly. The ambassador to Spain took some merino sheep to North America, 21 rams, 21 male sheep, and 70 ewes, 70 female sheep. U-E-W-E, that's how we spell it. So yes, la oveja, hembra, and that's the E-W-E. And yes, that causes all kinds of... the root of all kinds of jokes in English. For example, question. What is a three-letter word for female sheep? And the answer? You. Right. Okay. When we talk about leche de oveja, you can see ewe's milk. This cheese is made of ewe's milk. E-W-E. So, 70 ewes and 21 rams, carneros, taken to Vermont. And in Vermont, it became absolutely, the most desirable thing to have. People went crazy. There was more and more of the merino sheep were imported, again, through Portugal. There's a place there. It's called Wethersfield. Wether, by the way, Wether is the El Carnero Castrado, right? Ram is carnero, which is, by the way, ram is carnero, and it's also ariete, right? If you want to destroy the door, you can use a ram. So, yes. Ram Ariete, Ram Carnero, but weather with W-E-T-H-E-R, not W-E-A, right? Not el tiempo que hace, no? It's weather Carnero Castrado, which, as far as I know in Spanish, doesn't have a particular name. But weather, a Weathersfield in New Hampshire. Weathersfield, because of weathers, you know, these are like cabestros, right, for toros. The castrated bull, the ox in English, that will have a pacifying effect on the rest, male or female. And so weathers are used, again, to lead around the ewes from field to field. They have an effect, a social effect on the group. And so, yes, there is a reason to castrate a ram. And Weathersfield in Vermont started a trend so that by the middle of the 19th century, no, 1837. In 1837, there were over 1 million sheep in Vermont. And the sheep owners were able to export this wool to the new, newly industrialized textile mills in Massachusetts. And so, well, there was a boom and there was a bust. Yes, the bubble burst. There was an excess of supply. And so demand fell. Remember that in New England, the land is pretty bad, right? The land is solid granite, filled with stones. And it's something that you simply cannot cultivate well. So that this alternative, raising animals, was viable for that time. But of course, much better land was opening up on the frontier to the west. And the economic movement of the United States, again, going from east to west. And yes, the boom transformed into a bust. Meanwhile, back in Spain, it was one of the enlightened, remember, ilustrado, the enlightenment, ilustración, one of the enlightened thinkers, his goal was to get rid of the privileges of the mesta, to, in addition to desamortización, right, get rid of the, entailment of bienes mostrencos, right? Derelict property or underused property going from hand to hand, without being divisible, without, being sellable, right? In ecclesiastic possession or, noble possession. Unused land. The idea that there are people without land and there is land without people. And that this is wrong. I'm talking about Campomanes, right? Pedro Rodríguez de Campomanes, one of the great intellectuals of his generation. And his solution, in addition to desamortización, was also this idea of getting rid of the mesta. And finally, promoting agriculture over sheep raising. These people were obsessed with the idea of, again, manufacturing and modernization in agriculture. And here you had, very delicate paradox because of many of these people were using ideas coming from France, whereas on the one hand, France was the perennial enemy, and on the other hand, you had the French during the Enlightenment using Spain as the prime example of the anti-Enlightenment, right? The criticisms of Spain were constant. And these were usually not done with any sort of real criteria, right? Not done after a detailed study, but rather simply the reflection of things that had gone on, 100 years earlier during the wars between Catholics and Protestants, right? The Protestant propaganda against the Spanish at that time, how cruelly they were treating natives in the Americas, and how barbarous it was. The Inquisition, for example, all of these things, simply unrecycled without any study, without any reason added, were simply poured out by thinkers calling themselves ilustrados, enlightened. And so, for example, you have somebody like Montesquieu, right, writing in the he's the one responsible in the theory of the laws for the idea of a system of checks and balances in government. Montesquieu, one of the worst, saying that in Europe there exist two extremes, said tolerance and intolerance. You can imagine who he is going to call tolerant and who he is going to call intolerant. And, of course, these ideas have come down to us, and we don't check their historical validity either. So, the tolerant ones, he said, represented on the one hand by England, tolerance. My regular listeners will remember right now that England, certainly in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, is no model of tolerance. But in any case, tolerance represented by England and intolerance represented by Spain. And this is what he writes, and this is what people believed, making it very, very difficult for Spanish enlightened thinkers to cite him. He said, yeah, in the spirit of the laws, he's saying that a hereditary monarchy has as its principal honor. Right? That's how you judge things. That's what you foment. Honor. In the system of hereditary monarchy. In democracy, what counts is virtue. And what people are trying to foment and use as a standard of judgment, virtue. Whereas, in a despotic government, like Spain, the only thing that you find, the only thing that works, is fear. And yes, the fomenting of fear. And examples would be the Spanish Empire, based on fear, the Church and the Inquisition, based on fear. Yes, despotic government. Although you are going to find proponents in Spain of precisely that, an enlightened despotism, so that you do have an absolute ruler, but if that ruler promotes enlightened people, right, todo por el pueblo, pero sin el pueblo, if they do the right thing and promote the right people, then that will actually work out better in the long run. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute.
A nuestra tienda física en Madrid, en la calle Orense 75. Y si no te viene bien, ya sabes, baugantienda.com.
Si los profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan. Un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831. 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from. From Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class, and the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at grupobaugan.com.
Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughan Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Prueba el método Vaughan con nuestro curso trimestral. Elige entre nuestra modalidad presencial o por videoconferencia. Y el resto, déjanoslo a nosotros. 3 meses de listening y speaking con los mejores profesores del mercado. Entra en grupovaughan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Vaughan.
El Máster en Inglés Profesional te ofrece este programa.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I began by talking about the Merino sheep, the Mesta, that association of sheep, or rather wool exporters, that was considered apt for gentlemen. And so you had the highest members of the nobility, grandees, right? Los grandes de España. In English, we say grandees. And members of the clergy, high members of the clergy, who were deeply, deeply involved in this. And because it was easy money, it was allowed to go on. A terrible impediment to the development of both agriculture and manufacturing in Spain. Because as all of this was being exported, a domestic textile industry was allowed to languish, languidecer. There were attempts to do something, right? To change around the laws of los gremios, the guilds. But nothing done. Then I was talking about, yes, those who criticized the Mesta from the Spanish Enlightenment, Ilustración, people like Campomanes. But how? That is a risky game, or it's a paradoxical game, because the Enlightenment, many of these ideas were coming from France, and France is a perennial enemy of Spain and is consistently using a stereotyped and very nasty idea of Spain to make its point, right? They are proposing themselves as the anti-Spain. Everything that France represents is just the opposite of what's going on in Spain. And I talked about the spirit of the laws by Montesquieu, where he says that Spain is absolutely the worst. In a book that I absolutely admire, Imperophobia, Y la Leyenda Negra. This is by María Elvira Roca Barea. The book is from 2016, so yes, 5 years old now. But a wonderful book. A book that I do hope makes its mark in terms of historiography and people who talk about history. She mentions the strength of this idea and the fact that the Leyenda Negra has been so incorporated and so thoroughly digested that we no longer see where it came from. In other words, when people who have gone to the university, when intelligent, educated people cannot say where the ideas they hold originated, then this means that these ideas are now part of the foundation. And yes, you will hear ideas both in and out of Spain, by Spaniards and by non-Spaniards, talking about how terrible these times were and all of the mistakes that were made, as if, according to Montesquieu, this is what Montesquieu writes, he says, there exist in Europe two extremes, one of tolerance and one of intolerance, represented on the one hand by England and on the other by Spain. Except that if you look into the history, you see clearly that England was no model of tolerance. Just the opposite. And you will see that Spain is no model of intolerance. Remember that at this time in France, you still had, let's call it extra-legal jurisdiction. You had the lettre de cachet. This was a place where people could be disappeared, right? You were completely helpless, right? Indefensible. You were defenseless against a lettre de cachet. Anyone powerful enough would simply be able to put you in jail or try you, and there would be no defense against this. In England, you had the Star Chamber, a secret court, a kind of Guantanamo. And this is no, this is no example of tolerance. And at the same time, they're saying that the Inquisition is iniquitous, and that you can disappear into one of the mazmorras, and one of the dungeons of the Inquisition, and that is the last anybody will hear of you, as if that kind of jurisdiction, the kind of jurisdiction that you would find in France or even in England, that existed in Spain. It did not. The Inquisition never did anything without writing it down. The Inquisition was one of the most formalized, absolutely rigorous, and by the book, and with lots and lots of procedure, and in its history, it really didn't step outside the line, didn't improvise. It always did things by the book. And we have the archives to prove it. So, just before the break, I was talking about some of the things that Montesquieu was saying about Spain. In the spirit of the laws, he talks to the inquisitors of Spain and Portugal, an imaginary argument for religious tolerance from a 10-year-old Jewish girl who is going to be burned in an auto de fe. And this is an exhortation trying to call Spain to open up. And it ends, therefore, non por lo tanto, if you do not give up your old prejudices, it must be admitted that you are incapable of enlightenment and of all instructions, that the nation is very unhappy that gives authority to men like you. Yeah. And this is what has come down to us. On the other hand, Montesquieu, like many Spaniards before and since, many of the arbitristas that I was talking about from the previous century, under the Habsburgs, the arbitristas saying exactly the same thing. For example, the dependence on the precious metals coming from the Americas is a very bad thing. Montesquieu says, gold and silver are a wealth of fiction. The more they increase, the more they lose their worth. So that Spain resembles, in her fate, su destino, no? The foolish king, whom it was granted that everything he touched turned into gold. Of course, we remember the story, the Greek story of Midas. And in English, we talk about the Midas touch. Everything you touch turns to gold. But of course, Midas himself discovered that with so much gold, he couldn't eat, he couldn't drink. And that, in fact, the Midas touch is a curse, maldición. Well, yes, that's true. And yes, many, many people saw this, not just the French. And yes, this comes down to us through the mouths of Spain's enemies, but it is nothing that Spaniards themselves had not been saying for a while. At the same time, you have somebody like Voltaire saying that Spain is a model of fanaticism and intolerance. But again, not looking at examples of fanaticism and intolerance in France, right? As Spain makes an easy target for these kind of criticisms. In any case, he was the one who singled out Torquemada as being somehow the model of somebody who was reprehensible. So yes, Torquemada, he says, responsible for bringing a form of jurisdictional authority to the Spanish Inquisition that is in direct contravention of human law. Its secret procedures made the whole of Spain tremble. Again, secret procedure? The notion of friendship and family disappeared. Brothers lived in fear of one another, the father of his son. Silence became a characteristic of this nation. We must also attribute to the Inquisition a deep ignorance of philosophy in which Spanish schools remain, while in Germany, France, England, and even Italy, so much truth was discovered and our sphere of knowledge was broadened. Spain as the model of superstitious ignorance. And all of these other countries as enlightened, right? Ilustrados. And of course, going back to the old theory of humors, right? The four humors of the body, blood, bile, no, hiel, or bilis, black bile, melancholy, and phlegm. Talking about how, for example, cold, wet countries produce phlegmatic people, but a hot, dry country like Spain is going to produce choleric people. And it is interesting, this the introduction of science into the categorization. Let's call it racism through science, because you do have that. Beginning at this time, in the Enlightenment, you have taxonomies of animals. Linnaeus, for example, talking about the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the different kinds of human being. This is where you have the first sort of racism. And institutionalized racism, because the races are all put in a kind of ranking from the most advanced to the most to the least advanced, to the most retrograde. And yes, the curious thing is that these scientific theories are published, but nobody questions them because of the intellectual cachet, I suppose. So many people are emotionally and intellectually invested in the Enlightenment that nobody is really going to question it. They would like to consider themselves enlightened. There were very few people who actually brought this into question. Now, one of the things that Pearl Cabrera mentions in her book is that this is absolutely not coincidental that I've spoken about this on an earlier program, that the war, the Seven Years' War, was a game changer. The French lost their American empire. In other words, this is like Aesop's fable of the La Zorra y las Uvas, right? The fox and the grapes, where the fox is unable to eat the grapes and convinces herself that those grapes must be inedible. Those grapes must be sour. In other words, the French, talking about the Americas, their scientists, talking about the Americas, now go into great sort of irrational diatribes against things from America, now that France cannot really participate in the in either North or South America. So you have somebody like the Comte de Buffon, in terms of geography, in terms of natural history in general, considered the master, the genius. And everybody reading him eagerly, reading every word. Well, Buffon says that American animals, animals in the Americas, are degenerate versions of the animals on the Eurasian continent. And so all that exists there is simply a bad version of what is already here. Much worse, there was a Dutch scientist, well-respected, De Pauw, who said that the atmosphere in the New World begins to attack people, Europeans, from the moment they arrive. And that Europeans who go to the Americas will immediately begin to degenerate, will be losing their essence from the minute they arrive. And Montesquieu himself, talking about how the criollos, Europeans of American birth, or American European society. Well, the criollos are in fact notably inferior to the European born. And yes, you get somebody like a Mexican Jesuit, a man named Francisco Javier Clavijero, who was expelled from Mexico when the Jesuits were expelled, right? One particular day, all over the world, simultaneously, the Jesuits were told to get their things and leave, that they were going to be taken to be deported. And Clavijero left. They were taken to the Papal States, most of them, but the Pope did not want them at this point, right? The Bourbons, in France, in Spain, the Bourbons had elected a Pope who was very anti-Jesuit. Later on, the Pope will abolish the order of Jesuits. And so he gave express orders that if ships arrived bringing the Jesuits, that they were to be attacked, right? They were supposed to fire cannons against any ship bringing Jesuits to Rome. So for the longest time, Clavijero was, I believe he was in Sardinia. Many of the Jesuits went to Genoa. But yes, some of them arrived in the Papal States. Clavijero went to Bologna, the University of Bologna. And there he made a discovery which truly shocked him, that Buffon, De Pau, and other unquestionably renowned scientists were speaking this way about the New World in general, and, for example, Mexico in particular. So he wrote a history of Mexico in order to defend and exalt Mexico. These people, again, writing without checking their facts, right? Without any contrasting evidence. Speaking off the top of their heads. And yes, this is an example of what in English we simply call sour grapes. The expulsion of the Jesuits, by the way, was not a good thing. Not a good thing for the Spanish Empire. Even in the short term, it had a terrible effect. There was a, let's call it a vacuum, certainly in terms of education. But yes, it precipitated a kind of reaction against this, well, arbitrary rule in Spain. This is, again, Dictadura ilustrada, enlightened dictatorship, we could call it. But if we are talking about the fomenting of industry and of agriculture, certainly in the New World, Jesuits were among the most important in this, right? With tobacco, cotton, rubber plantations. And certainly in terms of the integration of the natives into Spanish society. And yes, these attacks did not go unnoticed here either. Carlos III ordered a prohibition on the import of the encyclopedia and demanded an apology. And at the same time, the Spanish Academy offered a prize for the best defense of the nation. And the winner of that prize was Juan Pablo Forner. Forner, a great student of history and a new way to write history, right? He says that foreign writers have blackened the reputation, right? Digging people like Philip II or the Duke of Alba out of their graves in order to satirize those who are currently in power. He says, if we were allowed to tell our own story, our true story, not as eulogists, but as judges, then we would be able to reject foreign exaggerations. However, our lethargy as historians encourages foreigners to tell stories that were invented 2 centuries ago, to denounce our empire building. And in this, he is absolutely correct. People, again, paid attention to Fournier. And in Spain, much of what they were doing at this time was rereading the writings of the Arbetristas, re-editing the writings of the Arbetristas from the Habsburg times, from the previous century. Okay, I seem to have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Pásate a vernos a la tienda de Vaughan. Sí, ya está abierta. Ven y nosotros te asesoraremos con el material que te puede ayudar a mejorar tu inglés. Con libros especializados en speaking, listening, grammar, vocabulary. Si quieres, te podemos hacer directamente un plan de estudio para que lo puedas hacer en tu casa. Y mejorar esas pequeñas cositas del inglés que tanto te cuestan con los mejores libros de enseñanza de inglés del mercado. No, no exageramos. Tenemos los mejores libros. Ven a comprobarlo a la tienda de Vaughan. Estamos en Madrid, en la calle Orense 75, esquina con Sor Ángela de la Cruz. De lunes a jueves de 10 a 6:30 y los viernes hasta las 5:30.